Welcome to Just Us and the Climate, a podcast by the Climate Justice Coalition, where we bring climate change back down to earth and show how it's not only a crisis, but an opportunity to build a better and more just world.
Welcome to Just Us and the Climate podcast, where we bring voices of communities, activists and thought leaders to the forefront of climate and social justice in South Africa. This month's episode is titled Beneath the Surface, Legalizing Artisanal Mining in Stilfontein. We focus on the intersection of mining justice, economic survival, climate justice, using Stilfontein as a case. I'm your host today, Kholwane Simelane, Deputy Secretary of the Climate Justice Coalition. With us in studio is Sabelo Mnguni, the newly elected National Coordinator of Mining Affected Communities, United in Action. Congratulations, Sabelo, on your appointment. How are you doing today?
Good day, everyone. Now we are doing well. Thank you for the congratulations. I'm also with our National Deputy Secretary, Bongani Jonas. He's also, one of the newly elected NEC members. We're doing well. We can't complain. We are still on our first week. So, we are taking baby steps. But, we've been in the struggle for long. So, we are not adapting to anything. We are fine.
Okay. That's nice. It's nice to know that you guys are cruising. Welcome, Bongani, also for joining us. I feel like you can jump on also at any point that you feel comfortable. I think just to set the tone, maybe start it off a bit here as to what is artisanal mining and what does it remain illegal or informal in much of South Africa, Sabelo, according to you? Why is that?
No, thank you. So when we talk about artisanal mining, we're talking about an activity that involves extraction of minerals using traditional tools. If one can maybe describe traditional tools, you're talking about your shovel, some they are using their bare hands. So depending on the mineral. At the moment in the country, we have existence of artisanal mining in the diamond sector, gold sector, chrome, coal. Platinum is still under the hands of the capitalists, so we are not exposed to it. So if we can say, you can answer the question to say why it remains illegal. As a movement, as Makua General, we don't refer to the term illegal because it's not regulated at all. There's no law that suggests that artisanal mining is illegal. So at the moment, the Department of Mineral Petroleum Resources is taking the MPRTA under review, where it's going to now regulate artisanal mining. The only thing that we have as a country, we've got what they call artisanal mining in small scales policy. It's only a policy. So in our perspective, it remains illegal according to the state because we as communities, we are systemically excluded in economic activities of the country. Irrespective, even in when you look at other sectors, you can go to banking sector. Your loan sharks are finding very difficult to operate. Taxi industry is also the same thing. But in the mining sector, only the multinational companies are allowed to mine in the country. You as a community member, you're not allowed. And remember, one thing we need to note is majority of artisanal miners in the country are former mine workers, formal mine workers. Some they were retrenched without receiving packages. Even today, they are still fighting. We've got almost over hundreds of former mine workers who are yet to receive their packages. Many of them, they went back to the mines that they were working to find surviving. So artisanal mining is all about surviving because it's an alternative economy. We can say it falls under informal economy at the moment. But its main objective is for people to survive. It's not for criminal syndicates or people that will once they've made some money around any mineral, then they will go and purchase things that will perpetuate whatever crime that they are doing. As we are being told in the media that there are criminal syndicates, they are doing all criminal acts, but the general artisanal mining is a basic mining process that is using traditional tools for survival.
Okay. Yeah, thanks so much, Sabel. I think you bring in a very important element, particularly around how in South Africa, there's this narrative that when the capitalists are not making too much profit from something, therefore it is illegal. And I guess that's the notion that we see coming into the fold, or very interesting about Stilfontein itself, is that I think when I had a conversation earlier with you, it was all about, you know, artisanal mining needs to be legal, and terms like illegal are not to be used within this, because just because someone is not making profit from this, it is then coined as illegal. And I mean, I guess there is that problematic tendency from departments to obviously voice out that way. Certain individuals in power are also benefiters of this. And I mean, we'll talk about this as we go through the day. Just a glimpse, because this conversation is shedding light on Stilfontein, I really want you to take me through as to what is happening on the ground in Stilfontein. What are the living and working conditions of informal miners there? Thanks.
Thanks. Maybe if I might give you just a lived experience of what is happening on the ground in Stilfontein. Remember before Operation Valamkoti, the community for the past 10 years, they were dependent on the economy on its own. But since we have seen the crisis that transpired currently in Stilfontein, it's a dire situation where we are now trying to partner with other humanitarian aids to ensure that livelihood in Stilfontein continues. And that's why we are also advocating for artisanal mining, also the sector, to be also formalized, also to be legitimized. Because of we have seen, according to their reports as the DMPR and government to say, to purport that about 70 billion of the minerals were and the resources of the country were accumulated through the sector. So I believe if we had leaders who have the will to deliver, we wouldn't be sitting with cases like Stilfontein. And I would maybe want to allude to the fact that whatever is currently happening in Stilfontein, it's continuously going to happen, because of what happens. It's the mining, the how the mining development outrolls. DMPR, inclusive of Mineral Council, they do not monitor, they don't even enforce legislation. So that's why as a country we are sitting with plus minus 6,000 derelict mines. So the situation in Stilfontein, it's continuously going to happen. Maybe if I might say in a language of us Africans, to say there's no how a situation where a cow will be guarded by a lion. You see, that's what the situation in the country currently is happening. Even if you can go down to the ground in Stilfontein, the plaintiff has changed, you know. And the only thing that you can see happening, it's continuous changing of narratives, but not actually attending to the real matter to say that how do we then address economical status and the socio-economic factors that are happening in Stilfontein.
Yeah. Thanks, Bongani. I think you bring in a very, very important element, which brings me to want to understand that how does criminalization impact miners and their families? I mean, Stilfontein is one of the cases that you also see that some of the it is said that some of the miners were arrested. And so, what does that mean then?
Okay, sure. Well, during the crisis, what we witness, as at first hand, was everyone that was arrested, they were taken through criminal processing. The only charges that we were able to impose upon them was around the contravention of the Migration Act, for them not having permits to be in the country. No one was prosecuted or found guilty or have contravened with a certain legislation in terms of mining. So no one was charged around illegal mining. So the criminalization that happens during that time, we said someone woke up with an erection and decided to run an Operation Valamkoti without looking at the socio-economic status of that particular community. So the criminalization, what it does, it creates victims of criminal syndicates, because now one, if the state is continuing to describe artisanal mining as illegal, it means now it drives the players of the industry underground. When I'm saying underground, I'm not saying underground in terms of going into the mine shaft. I mean they'll operate underground without being seen. And we know everything that is being done underground, and then it creates an environment for people to be exploited. So the criminalization of artisanal mining, it creates an environment for workers in particular to be exploited by those who control them. Two, it creates an exploitation in terms of remunerations. How they exchange the mineral vis-a-vis the money. It's not always parallel. It's not always equal. It creates an inequality.
Yeah.
So there's those who've got power, there's those who just workers. And remember again, it also what it creates the environment that you'll find our brothers that are coming from these neighboring countries who don't have documents. They work in that area, they get victimized because now if I'm abused as an undocumented person, where am I going to report? So my rights as a worker or as a citizen or as a person are not respected because of the criminalization of the industry. So it on its own, how the state is approaching or deciding to label the sector, it creates that victimization. It creates that environment for those who are working the sector, the players, to be continuously victimized and continuously be driven underground, to the extent that for them to survive, they use force. They use force upon their workers. They use force amongst them as colleagues. And there's no way of sitting down or SAPS to come in to find a common ground, because everyone is regarded as a criminal. When they see you, they arrest you. And again, what it does, it gives police powers to abuse people. Because now, one, what they do is they judge you based on how you look. And they say, you look like a Zamazam, come here. Then you are arrested. There's no procedure or a system that they're using to distinguish between a normal citizen and an active artisanal miner. Because all of us look the same. Because when they come back from work, it's not like they wear what they wear underground. They wear their normal clothes. They carry bags. So anyone, in Stilfontein, what we saw, anyone who was carrying a backpack was being stopped. Everyone, including women. So the criminalization of the sector by the state, they create an environment for people to be victimized in a lot of manners, including women. Remember, this sector is not only male dominated. There are females who are within the sector. They play different roles. So when they see a police van comes, obvious, everyone runs. So what happens to women who can't?
Yes.
Yeah, you understand? So even when you are arrested, it's very difficult to receive assistance, because now your brother that is with you in South Africa from Lesotho or from Mozambique or from Eastern Cape, it's very difficult for them to come and look for you in the police station because they might be arrested as well. So there's a lot of victimization and abuse that takes place because of how it's being framed at this current moment.
Wow, this is really hard-hitting. I guess for the listeners, they can also just get a feel as the way I'm feeling right now. And I think you've brought in also an element of gender justice in this case. And I want us to dive deep to a bit of what role does gender play in artisanal mining spaces? As you have said, I think you've mentioned briefly that it comes across as a male-dominated space. But what is the gender play?
So, yeah, thanks. So, in every economic sector or economic activity, as people in general, biologically, we need to eat to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's where, one, the majority of our female artisanal miners, they come in. Now I'm talking about the gold sector. Remember, artisanal mining is across the board. It's not only focused on the gold sector. Stilfontein is focused in the gold sector in terms of artisanal mining. So in the gold sector, women play that particular role of, one, having to supply food to the miners. Two, it creates an economic activity again in terms of, remember those who normally go underground, they've got families. Some of them, they've got wives and children. Some of them, they don't have. So now it creates a space where my kids needs to be taken care of by somebody. Somebody needs to be around and maybe assist in terms of taking care of the household. So that they also come in. Then in the actual extractive space, back then what they used to do, they used to do the function of crushing stones. Nowadays is evolving. Artisanal mining is evolving, especially in the coal sector. So now they are using what we call the pendugas to do the stone crushing that was done by women back then. In other areas, women work as medical care givers, because obviously in every industry, in any economic activity, there are casualties of some sort, there are injuries, there are illnesses that one acquires. So they normally come in that regard. And what we have seen in Stilfontein in terms of the role of the women are the ones that sounded at the alarms to say, my husband is underground, my brother is underground. They were in the forefront in terms of ensuring that as nation, we pay attention to what is happening as the state comes in to ensure that assistance is given. If we can remember the case that brought the state to agreeing to say, now we'll bring in a professional rescue team, is the case of Zinzile Tom. As a female comrade, she was in the forefront. That also reminds me what was happening around the past laws, something that you are not being told. There's a history that, sorry to divert a bit, just to highlight the role that women are playing, especially in advocacy for human rights. 1956, we know they marched it and they fought against the past law.
Past laws.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What we are not being told, who are the instigators of that? And of which what we know from the ground is that the Lesotho Basotho women are the ones who were in the forefront of the struggle. But generally, yes, women do play a key role within the sector. Some of them are active miners. It depends on how deep or how on the mineral, number one. It depends in the gold sector. It depends how deep is the shaft that they are working. In shafts that are shallow, you will find some of them are actively mining there. So yes, it is male dominated, but yeah, we do see our female counterpart do play a key role in the sector.
Wow.
In the alternative side of the sector, in terms of the household and all the unpaid labor, if I can use that sense, of taking care of everyone in the household, ensuring that the money that the miner brings home is utilized within the house, and accordingly everyone is taken care of, kids go to school. Yeah. Basically they do what we call financial management, if we can use English.
Of the household.
Of the
and
household.
I mean, for the longest time, women are at the forefront of any struggle that we look at in the past. I think I like what you're bringing in and actually alluding to past laws and how it came about. Now just bringing us back into our conversation, are there any successful models in South Africa or elsewhere for legalizing and regulating artisanal mining?
Yeah, Bongs will take this one. Yes, they are.
Yes, they are. Let's maybe, if Sabelo might have advocated that the main focus is not only on the gold sector. For example, let's look at in Kimberley, where we are speaking of formalized artisanal movement, like they have permits. But now our concern was, why is it that they are able to offer, to issue out permits in the Northern Cape and fail to do that in the gold sector? You see, and I believe in terms of models also, for example, the only thing that we have discovered in the sector, it's that there is a high use of rudimentary equipment, and the other issue is, we were shocked even when we were on the ground that we were even walking on top of gold, because we are not even exposed to what is gold and what is not gold. So I think maybe if there can be platforms created also, maybe to sort of create an alternative economy, to say, you see, if one man's trash, it might be one man's treasures. So that's also part and parcel of what we are actually trying to advocate for.
So, yeah, in addition, just to add what Bongs is saying. So
Sure.
What happened during, it was 2016 when we were able to advocate for the artisanal miners in Kimberley to get the permit. So at the moment is that the state does give. The thing is, the state sometimes is not honest to the public. They act as if there's nothing that is happening. They did give artisanal miners in Kimberley, Namaqualand, in the Northern Cape, permits. And even today, those permits are still being given. But the thing is, those permits are only for surface. Understand? It's for surface mining. For underground, we are yet to. That's where the process is at the moment. But still, the manner in which they are phrasing it, or the manner in which they are proposing to give permits for underground, it doesn't liberate the communities. But in terms of success, yes, we were successful in Kimberley, and even today, the comrades in Kimberley, they are still using that permit. The unfortunate part about that permit, one of the barriers is expensive. It's a couple of 200 to 300 to 400,000 just for you to get that permit. But then nonetheless, it is a success. And it was done before even the current Minister of the Mineral was in office. I think it was Mseben Zizwane during 2016. It was Mseben Zizwane who was the minister then. Then the current minister came in and reversed almost everything. So now it's difficult to even acquire that permit. It's difficult to acquire a permit for those who are underground. And it's another thing, again, that the state is not pushing for us as communities to know or to understand. In the current MPRDA, not the bill, the one that is being proposed for amendment.
Proposed.
We've got what we call under Section 104. Section 104 is clear to say we as communities, we should be given a first preference in terms of ownership according to the current laws. But in terms of implementation or success to acquire that permit under Section 104, every community that we met that is trying to acquire the thing is a challenge. Because of the conditions of the Act itself, it requires you to show a financial muscle, the ability to run that particular mine. Where are you going to get that money? That's where exploitation comes in. You will find me as a South African, as a Sabelo, I'll apply under Section 104. Then I will then need to have an investor. And we know it's South Africans generally, or it's the southern part. Let's use southern. Now we talk about SADC. This thing of being South African, we're being xenophobic. So as a SADC, it's very difficult. We don't have access to capital in general. So applying for Section 104 is a disadvantage because it requires you to show that you are capable to run that particular mine. And again, that Section 104 on its own, we have a problem with it because now what it does, it doesn't give us allowance to own a mine, but it says dam sites. We need to own dam. We need to deal with the dam sites. We need to deal with, we normally call them tailing dams, where the mining waste, basically. It only give us the permit to work the waste of those mines. But where there's critical mineral or where there's mineral ore, we are not giving a permission to do so. So we are in the state. We are in a deadlock at the moment. There's minimum success. Kimberley is a reference. There's minimum success in terms of Section 104 in the MPRDA. There's none a success in terms of underground mining. In Skukune, comrades are trying to mine chrome, and they are being arrested left and right. And chrome is in their backyard. It's not like they go into an active mine shaft and try to mine coal. It's in their backyard, but they are not allowed to. Same thing is that's happening in Mpumalanga around the coal region. It's the same thing. If you are found with a bag of coal, you are a criminal all of a sudden. Same thing what is happening in the coal sector. It's the same thing. Even those who try to work the dams, if you find you in the dump, it's a problem. So yeah, there's a lot that needs to be done, but there is something that has been done in 2016, of which we'll forever cherish it as a success for us because it happened in the current environment, in the current environment where legislation doesn't allow communities to own mines. How did Mseben Zwane do it if the current minister is failing to do so? So it's a question that...
Okay. Sorry to cut you short there, Sabelo. I'm just reminded of also when how communities speak about SMPs and some of the things that some of these companies obviously have left us, they leave the place like that. There's no sense of monitoring that place after they've obviously mined for that gold, when obviously the community members are unemployed at that time because a mine or any form of development here in our country, as we may know, it takes 20 to 30 years for that whole process to happen. So they can extract, take and leave. Then they leave us to obviously fend off the crops. And obviously now our people are arrested simply because of someone else's mistake. But I don't hear the conversation of those people or those multinational corporations being held accountable in this, in the context of you closed, you've left, and now you've left a lot of harm to the environment, to the communities nearby. The water is contaminated. We see that in Mpumalanga. We see that in parts of the Northern Cape that I've also seen actually live diamond miners actually looking for diamond or surface, basefa itaiman in essence. And that's a small community in the Northern Cape known as Wonderklipbaai. Literally, when you go in a community, you will find people actually looking for diamond, and it's very accessible. You even walk on top of it because it's like, if you don't know it, you won't know. You can even walk. Imagine, maybe a walking millionaire, you don't even know. But I mean, one of the things that I want to bring us to our conversation is, how do we ensure, like, how do we really ensure environmental sustainability alongside economic survival in mining towns?
Okay. Yeah, no, we'll come in there. So, one, you want to issue the issue of rehabilitation. Again, the state is not being honest to the public. So what happens is, during the application of the mining permit or mining license, me as an applicant, I need to put aside, one, the SLP budget as part of the requirements for me to apply. Two, I need to put aside the rehabilitation fund.
Mm-hmm.
Before I even receive the permit or the license. Where does that money sit, especially the reputation fund? It sits with the DMR. All mining companies that are holding licenses at the moment, they are the monies that were put aside for reputation is with the department, is with the government of South Africa. So in terms of reputation, the person that needs to be accountable is the state, because they hold the funds. Secondly, the mining companies also, they need to be held accountable in terms of reputation, because now mining takes place in three stages. Is development stage, is the running, is the operational stage, and there is the decommissioning stage. So if your mine is set to operate for 10 years, the first 2 years is for development, the last 2 years is for decommissioning, where you are starting the reputation process slow using the funds that are sitting with the department. So in terms of ensuring environmental sustainability, one, I'll speak in terms of artisanal mining. Artisanal mining, okay, where the multinational companies cease to operate. They don't just open new grounds and mine. They see an abandoned mine and they go in and continue to work. It might be in the diamond sector, it might be in the coal sector, it might be in the coal sector. They normally work where there's an abandoned mine. So what needs to happen is, through this regulation process, the state needs to work with the players. The problem is, the state is not working with the players. We are trying to regulate soccer, but you're not a football player yourself. So that's one of the issues. So you'll find that, one, working with the people who are playing the game, we'll able to understand as to what is needed to ensure that, one, we don't contaminate the environment. Some NGOs are assisting at the moment to say, those who are in the coal sector, they need to move away from using mercury. They need to start using borax as a chemical to extract gold from other properties or other from the ore itself. So, secondly, mining is using a lot of water, to be honest, and we know we are a water scarce country. So that's where technology comes in. We need to embrace technology in that regard. We saw in Stilfontein. I will continuously mention that one. In Stilfontein, we were using a rope to extract people from underground. In 2 weeks' time, they were able to build something that doesn't exist in anywhere in the world. A cage that can able to go to underground and come back with people. Mm. That cage was the first time it's being established. So what happened with that cage was an indication that where there is a way, where there is a will, there is a way. So introducing technology would also assist in terms of environmental sustainability. because now we know environment technology does have elements of making things much easier and less of a harm towards the environment, particularly in terms of water and using chemicals that are harmful towards the environment itself, like your mercury. Mercury is, as we know, even in DRC Congo, they are trying to find ways of moving away from mercury, introducing borax. Mm-hmm. So the more we work with other stakeholders who are privy to technology, who are privy to chemicals, who are the players of the game, there will be environmental sustenance. So another example of environmental, what can be done in an abandoned mine, if we say we are not continue to mine as artisanal miners, we can use Gold Reef City. We continuously use Gold Reef City as an example. A Gold Reef City is an alternative economy of mining. It's not a theme park. That theme park is built on top of a mine, on a mine shaft. So introducing alternative economies will save the environment again. You understand? So where there is degradation, we can find ways of bringing an alternative economy, or continuously continue with mining, introducing technology that will save the environment and the workers and the planet itself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bongs? Yeah. So, Sabelo, before Borani comes in, I think you are really bringing about a fond memories of Gold Reef City. When I actually went there, when I was very young, I think I was in grade 3 or 4. There's a part where we were going through the mine, and they used to say, if you can lift up this gold, you'll go with it. And so I'm just taken aback by that when you speak of Gold Reef, because that gold brick was really big. And I just wondered, how will anyone pick this up? And they wanted you to only use your thumb, and I think the hand just after that. Lift it like that. Don't lift it with your whole hand. And so no one got it. I still want that gold, though. Borani, please come in.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to, because of we still in Stilfontein, I wanted just only maybe to make a lived experience also, maybe in terms of when we talk of what transpired. For example, when we went down to Stilfontein, that mine did not have owners. And all of a sudden, there's people who now owns the mine. Now, part and parcel of my concern was, if the state can be in a position to go and safeguard the interest of these multinational companies. For example, they said there's no company owning the land. All of a sudden, there is a company. But now, why is it that the state projected all of its resources to go and safeguard all these shafts whilst there's companies, private companies, meaning the injustices that took place there, it was on the basis of to see that our state can be in a position to take our resources and protect the interest of multinational companies. For example, you can see even, for example, you cannot say a place belongs to somebody whilst there is no fencing. There's no proper shutting down of these areas. For example, we're still talking of issues of rehabilitation. And that's the actual thing that leads people to artisanal mining. PMG mined, ran away, and then people who worked in PMG did not benefit anything, and the houses demolished, sports facilities demolished, and then the community is disgruntled. Whilst there is funding that the mines had paid into the coffers of DMPR. So we do not know how best maybe we can charge DMR to ensure that DMR releases those funds to go and rehabilitate. Because of the funds, it clearly indicates that from mining company A, before even operation and beyond operation. So that's the current issue that we are sitting with, the will.
The political will of obviously putting people first before profit. I think that's what you are alluding to, Borani, and I think that's a very important element. And I think this also speaks to how our government doesn't respect the National Environmental Management Act, NEMA, that particularly speaks also directly to the public participation of communities in any form of development or any form of reforms that may take or might take place within the communities that exist. I mean, just to close off, I have the very last question to you both, and I really would like to hear your thoughts on this last question. And that is, what reforms or actions should listeners advocate for?
Okay, I will start then. One, when you look at the preamble of the MPRDA, the preamble is clear. It says the minerals, every citizen needs to benefit equally within the minerals of the country. So the realization of the preamble of the MPRDA, I think this should be a start, to be honest. Because that's what we need to advocate for as a society, to say we are not benefiting, we are only benefiting as employees. And remember, working in a mine, sorry, just to prolong a bit. Working in a mine doesn't bring success. What it brings is brings pain more than anything else. In what sense? I'm a mine worker, a formal mine worker. I contact sickness in the mine. My family lives closer to the mine. When the mine blasts, any electronic that I bought with the money that I'm earning in the mine, I need to replace it because of the blasting that I'm doing when I'm at work. Once I've stopped working, I leave employment with chronic diseases. That UIF money will go straight to the medical expenses. Then we are left poor again. So working in the mine doesn't change our lives in any sense. Instead, it brings more issues. So the realization of the preamble of the MPRDA should be the start to say the law says we need to benefit equally. Why is not happening? That's the question that we should be asking. Why is not happening? Where is the law says equal? What is that equal looks like? Does it say I need to be a contractor in the mine? Does it say I need to be an employee? What does it say? What is equal? What is equality? So we know South Africa is the number one unequal country in the whole world. Yet it's a constitution that is said to be nice. And we've got the MPRDA that has a preamble that we need to benefit equally, but we are not realizing it. Why is that so? Then, there's FP.
Once?
Yeah, Sabelo said mouthful. Mine would be legislative reform. And also living up to the realization of the MPRDA, you know, so that communities should start being inclusive. You know, we don't want to be consulted. Instead, we want a free and prior informed consent. You know, you are not a tag along. Communities are tired to have middlemen and be tagged along and just to come there and consolidate issues by signing signatures. And last but not least, I believe that as mining affected communities, we want to poll for a national referendum for a state elect. We are tired of these political parties because of the only thing that they are doing, they are interested in, it's to support and continuously support their game and in the game. So that's it as far as I believe. Sharp.
Thanks, comrades. I think the conversation was really fruitful. And I mean, as a way in which I wrap up, I would encourage all the listeners to follow us on the socials at Climate Justice Coalition, CJC South Africa, and also follow at Makua on any social media platform. Use hashtags such as Mining Justice Now, Legal ASM, Climate Justice. Visit our website to sign the petition calling for the formalization of artisanal mining. Collaborate with us, whether you're a student, researcher, lawyer, activist, there's a place for you in this fight. Stay tuned for more episodes and connect climate, labor, gender, and land justice. Amanda.
Thank you for listening to Just Us and the Climate, a production of the Climate Justice Coalition. To find out more about the coalition and our work to advance climate justice, visit climatejusticecoalition.org. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and share it widely. The more people it reaches, the more we can help grow the movement for climate justice.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.